charge is reconvened. Your silence is commanded.
Before we begin with our second case of the morning, my notes tell me we have students from Edgewood High School here, and if they're here, will they please stand? Oh, wonderful. You just fill up our courtroom. That's awesome. You may be seated. The students are here on a program called Court with Class, so they know a little bit about the case that you will be arguing to the court today. If you can stay after the conclusion of this argument, Justice Daniel Kelly, who sits down here at the end of the bench, will come down and chat with the students and anybody else who would like to stay too about the Supreme Court. He won't be talking about the substance of a case that we're about to hear, but I'm sure he has a lot of interesting things that you will enjoy learning about if you have the time to stay. I'm going to call the second case, Maple Grove Country Club versus Maple Grove Estates Sanitary District. Before you begin, I want you to note that the chair next to me, where Justice Shirley Abrahamson sits, she is not here today, and she has withdrawn from participation in the case. So she won't be participating by phone or any other way. And with that brief announcement, are you prepared to begin, counsel? Please do.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Mark Steichen. I have the privilege of representing the petitioner, the Maple Grove Country Club, LLC. The bottom line in this case is whether the club will be able to proceed with its statutory inverse condemnation claim. There are two issues. The respondent, Maple Grove Estate Sanitary District, has raised the notice of claim argument as a defense. The first issue is whether the district waived that defense by failing to plead it as an affirmative defense in its answer. The second issue, the court doesn't need to reach if it rules that the argument or the defense was waived. The court may wish to address it even if it finds that the defense was waived to provide guidance for future cases. Now, this is an unusual situation in that this court on five occasions has ruled directly on point that the notice of claim statute, section 89380, is an affirmative defense that must be pled in an answer or it is waived. They're all, and those precedents span from 1968 to the most recent case in 2007. Nothing has changed in the statutory language since then.
Counsel, just so I understand, I understand the facts correctly, at the moment the district is in possession of the water treatment facility.
Yes, it has been in.
That's correct. Okay. And what you are wanting the inverse condemnation matter to go forward for is because you want a setting of the fair market value of the property.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you. I just want to be sure I was on same page.
And what's unusual in an inverse condemnation case is normally, if they had proceeded with the regular condemnation proceedings, there would have been an appraisal that they performed to obtain, to determine a value. The district would then have had to pay for an appraisal by the club to get a evaluation. And then before the district could take the property, it would have to pay at least the amount of compensation is the jurisdictional offer. So the club would have had money at that point and could use that to fund it. So that's one of the key distinctions.
So, counsel, you said there's cases that support your position on waiver. What about the ones that don't? What about Thorpe, which was a case pretty recently where the court just accepted that it wasn't waived or never discussed it? That's 2000, and that's our court. And then what about Lentz and Robinson? What do you do with those cases?
Starting with Thorpe. Thorpe reaffirmed that it is an affirmative defense that must be pled. It was not an issue in that case. It had been pled in the answer. But the decision that, or the reasoning of the court was that it is an affirmative defense. And the district, in its briefs, has acknowledged that Thorpe stands for the proposition that it is a waivable affirmative defense. With respect to Lenz, Lenz was relying on the Robinson case. Thank you. Robinson did not involve the notice of claim defense. It involved a statute of limitations defense. And if I recall correctly, it had been pled in the Robinson case in a proper manner. The statute of limitations is one of 10 enumerated affirmative defenses that can be raised by a motion to dismiss apart from an answer. So Robinson was not directly on point. And I'm not sure why the Court of Appeals in Lenz relied on that case and did not mention any of the other cases. In fairness, in reading the Lenz decision, there's only one paragraph where it talks about the defense in that case involving workers' compensation as an exclusive remedy was not pled as an affirmative defense, but rather was raised on a motion for summary judgment. It was a very brief one-paragraph explanation pointing to Robinson. The court did not refer back to the statutory pleading rules in Chapter 802, and those statutory rules are the basis of the determination that this is an affirmative defense. It must be raised in the response of pleading or else it is waived. So, and nothing has changed. Now, the district has a couple of different responses. They have four arguments, basically, to get around the waiver.
I'd like to stay with the cases before you go to that new area. Do you mean by a response of pleading something other than a motion?
Yes. A response of pleading is the answer.
That's
I should step back. A motion to dismiss, it would be a response of pleading, I believe, as long as it is brought or, well, it can – let me step back.
That's an interesting question. I've always, I mean, thank you. That's a good question to ask, she said. I've always thought of a response of pleading as an answer, your first question. And then I ask, because in the Town of Lebanon case, the Thorpe case, what happened there was the complaint was filed, and in paragraph 13, in response to the complaint, the county moved to dismiss the Thorpe's complaint for failure to comply with the notice requirements contained in 89380. And so there, the response was by motion, not by answer. Is it your position that it's okay, it's permissive in response to a complaint to raise file a motion to dismiss for failure to comply with the notice requirements?
No. The reason is...
But Thorpe, that's what they did.
Well, that was the way it was done. I don't recall that that was an issue that was being...
It was not an issue. It was
right.
Part of the...
So, and that's the thing. When there are issues that are not being brought to the court's attention that were not in contention... it's hard to criticize the court for, you know, not looking deeper into it if the parties haven't briefed it. And I suspect, without knowing, that that may have happened in the Lenz case. Certain affirmative defenses can be raised in a motion to dismiss, and perhaps in that sense it might be considered a response of pleading. But that's limited to the 10 enumerated defenses, including the statute of limitations, which was at issue in the Robinson case.
Would you need that statute setting forth the 10 exceptions if a motion to dismiss is a response of pleading?
A motion to dismiss would not be a responsive pleading, and I don't recall the exact wording, but I believe that 802.02 defines what a responsive pleading is, actually. And a responsive pleading to a complaint is an answer. To a complaint is...
Mm-hmm. That's right. But so you can make a motion to dismiss for failure to state a claim, and you do that before you make an answer.
Right, right. So there is actually a statutory definition of what a responsive pleading is, and it does not include the motion to dismiss. But, you know, in everyday practice, I think most of us think of that as being a response, because with certain affirmative defenses, you can bring them by motion.
So isn't it good enough that a motion to dismiss for failure to comply with the notice requirements, isn't it good enough as long as it is filed before a responsive pleading, the answer is filed?
I don't think so, because the rule is, the statutory pleading rule, is that affirmative defenses must be raised in a responsive pleading, and that they may be raised in a motion to dismiss only if they are one of 10 enumerated affirmative defenses.
What sense does that make?
Well, you're asking me what the legislature had in mind.
No, give me your idea of why it makes sense.
I think probably some of these the things that are enumerated seem to be ones that aren't particularly factually driven. For example, the statute of limitations. We know when the complaint is filed. Generally, we're going to know the date of whatever the cause of action started on from the complaint. So in that sort of situation, you can file a motion and say, okay, you can just, that's all you need to look at.
Discovery rule, though, that's a different thing. That might require some facts. Right?
It might require facts for statute of limitations, but in many cases it would not. Okay? Failure of sufficiency of process, failure to serve process properly. That's something that you're going to have the record. That has to be, proof of service has to be filed with the court. So as soon as that complaint is filed, and shortly after, before a response is due, you're going to know that. So that, I think, perhaps was some of the thinking behind the legislature's decision on which to include. And even with respect to those 10 affirmative defenses that may be raised by motion, that motion to dismiss has to be filed before a responsive pleading. So there's a big difference between a motion to dismiss and a motion for summary judgment down the line, which is where the district in this case raised it for the first time. The district argues that, in fact, this is not an affirmative defense, that the court should adopt the same rule that applies to the notice statute with respect to claims against state employees, 893.82. This court has recognized that there's a difference in the rules in with respect to state employees. It's jurisdictional. If you don't comply with the statute, you're out. Doesn't matter whether it's pled in the complaint. Doesn't matter whether it's pled in the answer. It can be raised at any time. But the court has recognized that there's a different rule applicable to the two different statutes. And the reason for that, as the court has explained, is the difference in the statutory language. The notice statute with respect to claims against state employees expressly says strict compliance is required. That is not in the claim statute with respect to local government. The other thing is, in the claim against state employees, the notice of circumstances must be filed within 120 days of the happening of the occurrence, which is underlies the claim. That 120 days is a hard and fast rule. In the notice statute with respect to local governments, there is an alternative that the legislature has provided, which is if you don't file it within 120 days, it's all right as long as the government had actual notice and was not prejudiced by any delay. And the court has looked at that and said, all right, substantial compliance is sufficient rather than the strict time deadline that's imposed. And this court has ruled in many, many cases that substantial compliance is the test with respect to 89380.
Counsel, could we compare and contrast 89382 and 89380? The county has said that 89382 is a jurisdictional prerequisite. Do you agree that you need to comply with that as a jurisdictional prerequisite? Do you agree with that?
Yes.
Okay. And jurisdictional prerequisites are not waivable.
Correct. Correct?
All right. So what makes 89380 a non-jurisdictional requirement as opposed to 89382?
The difference, in part, is the state has sovereign immunity, and the state grants permission to be sued only on the terms that it agrees to be sued upon. And in that statute, 89382, for claims against state employees, it says specifically strict compliance is required. That's, and so the legislature has very clearly said, that's it. If you don't meet that, then the state has sovereign immunity. So it would be jurisdictional. In the notice of claim statute for local bodies of government, you have the alternative to strict compliance of the situations in which the local government had actual knowledge and was not prejudiced by the delay. And in this case, what's important to keep in mind is the date of taking, as determined by the circuit court, and which is not disputed, was January 1st of 2011.
Before you go down that track, could you explain to me why strict compliance creates a jurisdictional requirement?
My understanding of the reasoning has to do with the sovereign immunity of the state, and that the state decides on what basis it can be sued.
And so if the statute said, as in horseshoes, close is good enough, right? If it said that in 89382, would it still be a jurisdictional bar?
I suspect not. As long as whatever, if 89382 was amended to have the same language as 89380, I suspect it wouldn't be jurisdictional.
All right. So this is more of a matter of statutory language than it is sovereign immunity.
Yes. It's sovereign immunity to the extent of why 89382, which applies to state employees, why it would be jurisdictional. But yes, the difference in the rules is based in the difference in the statutory language. If 89382 was written in the same way, then it probably would not be jurisdictional.
Have payments been made to the club? Well, better, let me phrase it differently. When was the last time the district made payments to the club for the water treatment facility?
February of 2010. Before the date of taking, there has been zero money paid since
that time.
There was a tender in 2015 of an amount of rent that the club had consistently said is not acceptable, and the club did not accept that payment. Other than that, zero.
Okay, thank you.
The district also argues that, well, we may not have pled the notice of defense precisely, but it's encompassed in some other affirmative defenses that we pled. One of them is they pled sovereign immunity. And they argue, well, okay, it's not really sovereign immunity. Consider it immunity. And then, well, immunity, you know, you look at 89380 and there's immunity in there, so really treat this as immunity. It relies on the case of Lodal versus Progressive Insurance. Lodal addressed subsection 4 of 89380, which is specifically an immunity defense. We're talking about a procedural process in subsection 1D, and it is a matter of you have to do certain things in order to proceed with your claim. Immunity in subsection 4 is a substantive bar on a claim. So they're simply trying to mix two different subsections that have nothing to do with each other. They then argue that this fits within their affirmative defense of failure to state a claim. And they make an argument which has confused some courts in the past. The rule is that compliance with the notice of claim statute is a condition precedent to recovery, a condition in fact. But there's a separate pleading rule that says if you're going to raise it, it has to be pled. And the courts have said, and Ray was discussed this very clearly, and it said you do not have to plead compliance with the statute in the complaint, period. Yes, if it's pled, then the claimant has to prove compliance. But if it's waived, then it's not necessary. And that's what happened here.
If it is a condition precedent, why can that not just as well be brought as a motion to dismiss for failure to state a claim? It's a claim can't be stated because the condition precedent has not been met. So could you respond to that?
Because as this court explained in Rave, it's not an element of the cause of action.
I understand that. Okay. I understand that it's not an element. It doesn't have to be pled, and therefore the argument to counter your opposing counsel that, oh, well, we made a denial in our, you know, our answer is good enough. I understand that. I'm just saying that, if I recall, one of the 10 under the statute 06 is a failure to state a claim upon which relief can be granted. Failure to provide notice is not one of the 10. Why isn't, given that it's a condition precedent, that subsumed, the failure to provide notice, subsumed in the overarching failure to state a claim if the predicate isn't done?
Well, and here's the reason. Failure to state a claim. State refers back to a complaint. So what has to be pled in the complaint? Once you have an issue joined as you proceed, introducing evidence of damages is a condition precedent to recovering damages. You have to meet the burden of proof. But that doesn't mean that you have to allege in the complaint that you will, in fact, introduce all of the proof that is necessary to prove the allegations. So there's a distinction there. The district has argued that its answer should be deemed admitted because of evidence introduced at what it calls a trial. There are several problems with that. It refers to a one-day evidentiary hearing that in which there was testimony from one witness. We have a hybrid situation here. There was a motion for summary judgment. It was denied at that stage. Then there was additional evidence presented, a limited amount in that one-day hearing, and most of it was in the form of documentary evidence by stipulation, number of stipulations of fact, and then a large amount of documents and deposition transcripts. So, and there were multiple scheduling orders in this case. Never did the district ask for leave to amend. None of those scheduling orders set out a bifurcated trial. There was a final pretrial date with a trial to be determined at the pretrial date. The other thing is that the district tries to squeeze this into a bifurcated trial, referring back to the inverse condemnation statute 32.10 and saying, well, that was a trial of, you know, the initial phase of the act. Problem with that is when you go back to the transcript of that hearing, I was advocating that we have this witness, let's cover all of it. And the district said, no, I object to that. Let's focus on the notice of claim defense. And the court said, all right, we're going to focus on that. So even if there were a bifurcated trial and a 32, an inverse, a statutory inverse condemnation claim, which there isn't, this hearing was certainly not a part of that.
Could they have moved to amend the complaint or the answer?
Sure.
Would that have been enough to add this as an affirmative defense at any point along the way?
No.
All right, and why not?
There are two ways in which one can amend. Before trial is governed by 802.09 sub 1. And there you have to move for leave.
Right.
And then the court has to determine whether justice so requires an amendment. And there may be situations in which, for whatever reason, you weren't aware that there might be an affirmative defense. And so in the process of discovery, you discover that and you say, I'd like to amend. And in a case like that, perhaps justice would require that to be the case. The second is only if it goes to trial and only if evidence is introduced without objection, then it would automatically come in. We did object. We objected from the very start when they raised this, that they had waived the issue. And even if we got beyond that, the court does have discretion to allow it even over the objection, but only if it's subservient the presentation of the merits or the defense of the merits of the action. What the district is trying to do is avoid consideration of the merits altogether. With respect to compliance with the statute, the circuit court in this case seemed to be confused with the idea that the district had to be provided with an amount of compensation within 120 days, or else there wasn't actual knowledge. That's not the case. There are two. Oh, I see my time is up.
You can finish your thought.
All right. There are two different paragraphs of the claim. There is one that has a 120-day notice or actual knowledge. That's only the circumstances of the claim. There's a separate paragraph that deals with the claim for relief. There is no time limit on that.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Morning.
Good morning.
May it please the court. My name is Craig Byron. I'm here representing the Maple Grove Estate Sanitary District. And the first issue is whether or not the district waived its right to assert the affirmative defense, or is it an affirmative defense of lack of compliance with the notice requirements. Council seems to acknowledge now that summary judgment was denied on September 15, 2015. So that means we are here under an erroneous exercise of discretion standard. This is not a de novo issue. This is a situation in which the petitioner must demonstrate that the trial court erroneously exercised its discretion when determining in this instance that there was not actual notice, and number two, that the petitioner had failed to establish prejudice. But
counsel, we don't get there, though, if you had an obligation to raise it in your answer. Can you address why it wasn't raised in your answer?
Well, I was not involved in the case at that time,
okay.
So
do you
I
know
can't,
why the district didn't? Do you have any idea?
Well, I think there are a number of things involved, Your Honor. First of all, I think the issue was effectively joined. It was asserted in the complaint that the plaintiff had complied with 893.80, and the district then denied that. I believe that effectively joins the issue as to whether or not the plaintiff has complied with 893.80. I also believe, as Justice Bradley had suggested, that there are affirmative defenses that do encompass the failure to satisfy the notice requirements.
I don't want to interrupt the Chief Justice, but I just want to clarify a point, because 80202 sub 3 says a party shall set forth affirmatively any matter constituting an avoidance or an affirmative defense. So I don't know that a denial would constitute setting forth affirmatively. Could you address that?
Yes. First, I don't believe that it is an affirmative defense. It's not one of the enumerated affirmative defenses under 80202. I understand that it says including but not limited to, but there are decisions out there. In particular, there's Anderson versus the City of Milwaukee, which was discussed by both of the parties in their briefs. And in that situation, the court addressed a lack of compliance with both 893.80 sub 3 and 893.80 sub 4. And if I may have get them mixed up, but I believe that sub 3 is the limitation on damages. And in that instance, the court said, no, you did not waive failure to assert the damages limitation because that should not be considered an affirmative defense under the statute.
But in Thorpe, the court said a governmental entity must affirmatively plead that a plaintiff did not comply with 89380.
Well, frankly, I believe that the jurisprudence of the court under 893.80 has not kept pace with that in relation to 893.82. The Menino decision talks about the fact that the courts previously regarded lack of compliance with notice provisions as a statute of limitations issue. And obviously, statute of limitations must be pled as an affirmative defense. That's one of the enumerated affirmative defenses that must be pled.
Counsel, what do you mean by our jurisprudence with respect to 89380 is not kept up with 89382? What do you mean by that?
Well, thank you for asking, and I think it coincides with what you were asking, counsel, for the petitioner. Why is there a difference between 82 and 80? Why is one a jurisdictional issue and one is not? And I don't see that there is a basis to distinguish between the two statutes. Counsel first suggested that it had to do with sovereign immunity. First of all, 893.82 deals with claims against state employees, not against the state itself. So sovereign immunity should not come into play. I don't believe it does come into play there. But beyond that, then counsel states, well, it has to do with the language of the two statutes. 893.82 requires strict compliance with the statute, whereas 893.80, you have the possibility of providing actual notice and demonstrating lack of prejudice. And the courts have interpreted that to mean that you have to show substantial compliance with the statute. That doesn't explain why under 893.82, the courts have stated, absent strict compliance, there's no jurisdiction. Then why under 893.80 would the courts not say, absent substantial compliance, there's not jurisdiction over the claim?
So why would you suggest that we should harmonize 893.80 and 82 in the direction of it being a jurisdictional bar? Why not harmonize it towards it being a condition in fact precedent to recovery?
I think either way, it bars the claim absent compliance with the notice provisions.
Well, we've said for a very, very long time that with 893.80, that's not a bar. It has to be affirmatively pled by the municipality.
But that's that the condition precedent to recovery, that same language has been used by this court and the appellate courts under 893.82 as well. The only difference is that for whatever reason, courts have said that under 893.80, it has to be pled as an affirmative defense, okay. And under 893.82, it does not.
Right. So if what you're urging us to do is to harmonize those two statutory provisions, and we're to harmonize that around it being a jurisdictional bar, why should we choose that as the organizing principle rather than choosing as an organizational principle what we said with respect to 893.80, which is it's an affirmative defense, and you waive it if you don't plead it?
A couple of reasons. Number one, the legislature has made a determination that both municipal entities and state employees will only be liable if the claimant has complied with the notice requirements. So the legislature has made that determination. And beyond that, it is in the express language of both statutes, 893.80 and 893.82, both say that you cannot commence, or I believe the word is bring, you cannot bring or maintain an action unless you do the following. So if that language in relation to 893.82 means that absent strict compliance with these requirements, you don't have jurisdiction to bring a claim, there's no reason that under 893.80, that absent substantial compliance, you have no jurisdiction to bring the claim.
Counsel, is there some mechanism other than inverse condemnation by which the fair market value of this property can be determined?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I think that this, the remedy that this litigant has, although interestingly enough, as counsel stated earlier, this was an arrangement that started out by successive rental agreements. There was one five-year term, there was a second five-year term, and then it was extended for an additional year. And the last communication that the district had from the club was April 30th of 2010. And that communication said it proposed a rental, an amount of rent that the club wanted. And the council for the club at that time said, if we don't have an agreement, we are going to have to bring a declaratory action to determine the fair rental value of the property. That is the last communication from the club until July of 2011 when it filed its notice of claim.
Okay, so they waited a year and nothing worked out rental-wise, and so they started an action for inverse condemnation. I mean, it troubles me, frankly, that the district can keep somebody else's property, be in possession of it, use it, and not pay them for it. And if there's some other way they should have been going around this, I have not been able to discover it, but, you know, you're much more involved in this case than I am. I thought perhaps there was something I was missing.
Well, if they could have sought to evict the district as a holdover tenant, I mean, because they...
Yeah, well, maybe they had some semblance of concern for the 45 families who would have no place to have their sewage treated if they did that, right?
That could be, Your Honor.
Okay.
The court should understand, too, that there were that the club also had usage fees. The club was not just the owner of the facility, it was a user of the facility. Mm-hmm. So it had unpaid usage fees for many years, and so that was a constant dispute between the parties. And the thing of it is, the courts shouldn't have the impression that this is just a situation where the district decided that, you know, we're just not going to do anything, we're not going to pay anything. This whole record is replete with communications between the parties where they're constantly discussing.
I can see that both parties tried to get together on something that they could agree on. I think it's pretty clear from the record, though, that you couldn't do that. And I guess now here we are, right? I mean, you've got a bunch of people that need to get their sewage treated. They're using a facility that belongs to somebody else, that they're in possession of it. So it's going to be, somebody's going to have to decide how to break the logjam. I mean, I think you would agree we can't go on like this forevermore.
Yes, absolutely. And just so, I believe the court understands this, but regardless of the outcome of this case, the club has a valid claim for inverse condemnation. We're not here about the club's ability to pursue or to obtain just compensation for its property. We're here today about litigation expenses. That's why the club wants to be able to proceed under the statute. And I think it's fair that if you want to avail yourself of the benefits of the statute, you should comply with the notice requirements that are established by the legislature. In this instance, the club wants to say, look, we know that we didn't satisfy our notice requirements, but because of this technicality, you should still allow us to recover these litigation expenses. Excuse me.
Thank you.
So you would ask us to say that it's not an affirmative defense and therefore it can be raised at any time if you were to decide, if they were to decide that there was no notice? or you were, I'm sorry, I said it backwards. If you were to decide that there was no proper notice, it could be raised at any time.
I don't know what any time, but I guess that's what it is. That is what the law says under 893.82.
Well, that's against a state, so it does. You agree the law doesn't say that under 893.80.
Well, it doesn't say it under either statute. That's the thing.
Right, but under 802.06, you're saying because it's not listed, you would have us read this to not be an affirmative defense. And no, it doesn't have to be raised ever if it's not an affirmative defense? I mean, how does this play out?
Well, it has to be raised at some point during the litigation, obviously. And in this case, it was raised on summary judgment. But I'd like the court to look at the Anderson versus the City of Milwaukee case that I started talking about. And the distinction there was, again, the court looked and saw that the damage limitation, that is not something that's an enumerated defense. Versus discretionary immunity, the court looked at that and said, hey, that's one of the enumerated defenses under the statute. You have to plead that one. And the court cited Wright and Miller looking at what really should have to be pled as an affirmative defense, and it looked at several different things. It looked at policies, it looked at fairness, and it looked at surprise, basically. And in this situation, if you look at the policy behind 893.80 is to provide municipalities with immunity from claims absent compliance with notice requirements by litigants. And the fairness, is it fair for a municipality to believe that it has the protections of a statute only to find out that, look, even though it's not enumerated as an affirmative defense, we're going to say that you have to plead this, otherwise you don't get its protections.
And Counsel, I'd like to follow up on Justice Dowlett's question. She asked if this is something you could just raise at any time. And you said, well, there might be some limitations on that. Why would there be limitations? If this is a jurisdictional requirement, and we've said that jurisdictional requirements cannot be waived, then isn't this just something you could bring up at any time?
I believe you're correct, Your Honor. I think courts have determine that as long as it is raised at some point during the proceedings, that that is sufficient.
What if this proceeded to a trial on the merits, and let's say you're trying the case and you don't think it's going so well? You can say, wait a minute, Judge, I need a sidebar. They didn't comply with the notice of claim statute. Could they do that? Could you do that?
I believe so. I believe you could do that under 893.82, since the court has
893.82. Are you finished?
Yes.
Okay. I am interested in looking at the statutes. And as I look at, and I'm not sure if you have them in front of you, so I don't want to.
Maybe you have them
committed to memory. And so, okay. Just in case. I'm going to start with 802.02(3). 802.02(3).
Okay.
Affirmative defenses.
Yes.
Now, as I read sub-3, it starts in part, in pleading to a preceding pleading, a party shall set forth affirmatively any matter constituting an avoidance or affirmative defense, including but not limited to the following. Then it lists a number of things. It does not list failure to comply with notice requirements. It does list failure of a condition subsequent, not a condition precedent, but our case law has said this is an affirmative defense, and because 802.02(3) says including but not limited, good enough. I think this is an affirmative defense. But I don't see in 802.02(3) any time limitation for that affirmative defense. It indicates at the end of 802.02(3) if an affirmative defense is permitted to be raised by motion under 802.06(2), it need not be set forth in a subsequent pleading. So it makes reference to there are affirmative defenses in 06, and as we know, 06 does have a timing requirement. 06 says for those motions that are enumerated in sub 2, 2B says a motion making any of these defenses shall be made before pleading. So I'm taking as a given that this is an affirmative defense, even though it's not listed. But there is no time limit. I hearken back to the question that's being raised now. Why can't it, and earlier in the discourse here today, why can't it be made any time? Why can't there be an amendment made to the answer raising it? Is there any limitation? That's number one for the statutes. Number two, we're talking about waiver, and of course, 802.06 sub 8 speaks of waiver or preservation of certain defenses. What moment is sub 8 in this discussion? Sub 8 specifically indicating that certain defenses are waived only if any of the following conditions are met. So two statutes I want you to focus on. Number one, with regard to 802.02 sub 3, can the pleading be amended at any time, or is there a limitation on time other than the 06 motions?
I believe that the statutes say that you have 6 months to amend your pleadings without leave of the court, and then thereafter you need to seek leave of the court to amend. And the district did ask for leave of the court to amend. It's not in the appendix, unfortunately, but it is in record number 94 from pages 21 to 26. At that point, that was during the summary judgment hearing. And it was over those five pages, and specifically the district asked to amend on pages 21 and 26 of that transcript.
During the hearing was the first time the district asked to do that?
Excuse me?
During the hearing was the first time?
I know it was, I believe it was referenced before that in discussions, but that was probably the first time that may have been on the record.
Was that within the 6 months? Period?
No, it would not
so
have
So you
been
need
with,
leave
yes.
To amend.
Correct.
Amending as of right. Okay. And what was the court's response to that request?
The court did not specifically respond to the motion. It did not grant it or deny it. The court went on in December of 2015 and litigated the issue. And it's our position that regardless of whether it was done with the consent or over the objection of the petitioner in that instance, the statute provides that once the issue has been litigated, basically what's done is done. And the issue of compliance with notice requirements was actually litigated by the parties and was not objected to at that hearing. And I'm not going to deny that there weren't, you know, points in the proceedings where counsel didn't say, hey, they waived that defense. But at that trial, there was no objection to the presentation of evidence on the issues. The district presented evidence on the issues. The club presented evidence
okay.
on the waiver issue.
Sub 8, then, waiver or preservation of certain defenses. Is that implicated in today's case? Since whether or not you waived it seems to be one of the issues. If you know.
I have not considered this question, Your Honor. So,
okay.
But given our previous discussion where we don't believe that, I mean, the decisions in, I believe in Robbie and others have said that it can't be waived. It can't be waived by the municipality, and it can't be waived by the court.
Counsel, is that perhaps because, I'm sorry,
because it's jurisdictional?
Correct.
Okay. And is it perhaps jurisdictional because of the waivability question? Right? So this is two sides of one coin. Jurisdictional issues cannot be waived, and the reason they can't be waived is because they're jurisdictional, right?
Yes.
So so we look for some piece of information to break us out of that circularity. And perhaps in 89382, we find that in sub 2M, which is the strict compliance requirement, right? And so as the court looks at this, they say, well, okay, so here's this claim against a state employee, and, oh, we've got this notice of injury requirement. And did you follow that? No, you didn't? Okay, I'm sorry, I can't help you, because here the statute tells me I can't do anything for you unless you strictly comply with this requirement, right?
Yes.
But in 89380, we don't see any language like that.
No, but in 893.80, this court has interpreted the ability to provide actual notice in lieu of the statutory written notice as substantial compliance. So once again, there's no reason why, if failure to strictly comply with the requirements of 893.82 is a jurisdictional bar, why the failure to substantially comply with the requirements of 893.80 should not likewise be a jurisdictional bar.
And here's perhaps why that might be. So let's say claim is made against a municipality, and they haven't complied with the notice requirements of 893.80. Presumably, the municipality could, if it wished, it could say, "Don't worry about it. We'll go ahead with the litigation, and we're not gonna raise that as a defense. We're not going to say the court doesn't have the authority to enter a judgment, you know, in the absence of your compliance with the statute." And there's nothing in the statutory language that says that the municipality couldn't do that, right?
There's nothing in the language of 893.82 that says that the state could not ignore.
Except that there is, right? It's the 2M piece, which says you must strictly comply. That's the legislature telling you and the complainant, you must strictly comply with this. And that says you can't waive.
But it only comes up if the defense is raised.
I'm sorry?
It only comes up, that issue only comes up if the defense is raised by the state.
Right. And that may go to whether the defense counsel was doing his job according to the statutes, right? This statute says your job, therefore, because the statute says strict compliance is required, your job as counsel for the municipality is to raise that. But there's nothing in 89380 that says strict compliance is necessary. And so perhaps, and it, you know, obviously it doesn't tell counsel you've got to raise that, so perhaps the issue is, do you choose to raise that or not? And it's a choice that the municipality has.
I don't believe that if you're looking at it from the ethical perspective of the attorney that there is a difference, because if you're representing the municipality and the claimant has failed to substantially comply with the requirements of 893.80, I don't believe it's within your ethical discretion to say, well, forget about it, we're not going to require you to substantially comply. You have an obligation to your client to raise the issue, just as you do under 893.82.
Except that, yes, and we're not looking at it the ethical angle, though. So council confers with the municipality, and for whatever reason, the municipality says, you know what, I don't want you to raise that issue. Could the municipality make that decision?
Just like the state could make that determination under 893.82.
Could they do that notwithstanding 2M that says, as a statutory matter, strict compliance is required?
I believe they could. They could make a determination under that, notwithstanding the statute, that they believe that this person should be entitled to recover, just as the hypothetical municipality under 893.80 could say, well, you have not substantially complied, but we think you should recover, so we're not going to raise a defense.
Why is 2M in there then?
2M is just there because, it provides that claims against state employees for whatever reason requires strict compliance with the statute. And frankly, I don't understand why that exists in regard to state employees and why it does not exist in regard to municipalities.
But it doesn't. So is there any reason to have that difference?
To have what difference?
Strict compliance in 82 and no such language in 80.
I don't know why a litigant is not required to strictly comply with requirements under 893.80, and they are under 893.80. But I think that goes to the fairness of the situation, too. A litigant under 893.80 is already getting the option of saying, oh, look, we're gonna forget about it. You don't have to provide the formal written notice as long as the municipality had actual notice within 120 days, and they were not prejudiced by the fact that you didn't file the statutory written notice. So that litigant has already getting far more favorable treatment than the litigant against the state, and now want to take it a step further and say we're going to require the municipality to say you have to plead this as an affirmative defense, but state, you know, don't worry about it. You don't have to do that. I don't believe that there is a distinction. There's no reason why one must be pled and what one does not. In both cases, failure to comply with the notice requirements is a jurisdictional bar. We do have the other issue.
Is it jurisdictional here with regard to this case, a non-state employee or non-state entity? I look at, again, my new friend, sub 8 of 80206, and that says under, I guess it is C, if it appears by motion of the parties, although otherwise the court lacks jurisdiction of the subject matter, this is subject matter, the court shall dismiss the action. What kind of jurisdiction are you asserting vis-a-vis 893.80?
There's no jurisdiction over the statutory claim, because in order to avail yourself of the benefits of the statute, the legislature has made a determination that you have to comply with the notice requirements. And in this situation, I believe that there are other bases upon which the court could find that the defense was pled, if it is an affirmative defense. And as the court alluded to earlier, I believe it's a failure to state a claim. If you fail to satisfy the notice requirements that are required of you as a litigant, you have failed to state a claim. If this also can be regarded as immunity statute, because the statute says unless you comply with these notice provisions, you cannot bring a claim against a municipal entity. So, in other words, barring compliance with the notice requirements, the municipal entity is immune. And I see my time is up. And we did plead immunity defense, and I believe that encompasses the 893.80 defense.
Just for point of clarification, if I may, where did you bring your immunity defense?
It was asserted as an affirmative defense in the answer, as was the failure to state a claim upon which relief may be granted.
Thank you.
I'd like to respond on a couple of points, and let me start with the question that was asked, why can't it be raised at any time? The ability to amend a responsive pleading is covered by Rule 80209. An answer can be amended as of right within 6 months. If they had done that, they could have raised it. If a litigant can ask the court for permission before trial to amend, but in that case, justice has to require it. Why? The district never asked to amend, never moved the court to amend, even though we had three amendments to a scheduling order. If they had raised it at the time that they did in response to the summary judgment motion, the problem was that the harm to the club is we had done the discovery that we needed to bring that motion for summary judgment. Once we had to deal with the notice of claim, we had to go back. I had to take the deposition of the district's engineer again to investigate what the district knew. We had to send out new discovery, written discovery requests and production of documents. That's why we found out what was going on behind the scenes. That's when we got the minutes of the closed session with the district saying in December of 2011, problem is not having valid leases. So it did put the club to substantial additional expense, and also it added a year or a year and a half to a resolution of at least to this point. That's prejudicial, and there's been no explanation for why they didn't raise it earlier. Another point on the amendment, council said that the statute says that if there's no objection, if the issue has been litigated, that the court can deem the answer amended. That's not true. 802.09 sub 2 says if the issue is raised at trial and not objected to. And we've cited a number of cases explaining that when it says at trial, it means at trial. It doesn't mean pretrial hearings. The statement was made that the last time the district knew anything about condemnation being claimed was in April of 2010, before the taking. That's simply not true, and I don't have time to go through all of the facts that we cited in the brief, but the notice of claim, notice of circumstances of claim that was filed in July of 2011 says the district is occupying the sewer system without paying compensation in violation of Section 32.10, the inverse condemnation statute, and Article 1, Section 13 of the Wisconsin Constitution. It says it right there. Condemnors don't have the right to just sit back and say, well, we'll wait until the property owner comes to us and forces us to condemn. Chapter 32 says, if you're going to take property, you shall pursue this procedure. Moreover, the district's ordinance, its own ordinance that it adopted in 1998, says you shall enter into an agreement for leasing or purchasing this. And if you cannot reach an agreement, and if you need this facility, you shall condemn it. So their own ordinance says that. In 2012, we discovered notes of phone calls from the district's attorney to the district's engineers in October of 2012 saying, do you have a better legal description? Do you have maps? Be prepared to use eminent domain to acquire. Then in March of 2013, in notes from the district's attorney to the engineer, district will now have to condemn to get ownership. It wasn't that the district had no idea that it was condemning the property or taking the property. What our discovery revealed was the district was deliberately holding back and saying, we're going to do as little as possible, and then we're going to wait, and the further along we get, the more financial distress there is, and we'll get it at a cheaper rate. In February of 2014, in September of 2013, a foreclosure action was brought against the club. And the record shows that the district at that point said, ah, now they're in foreclosure. Now maybe they'll be more reasonable or we'll get a new owner to deal with. In July of 2014, while the foreclosure was, I see my time is up.
You can finish your thought.
In July, the district was actually negotiating with the bank for the bank to condemn the property or for the district to buy the property from the bank at a cheaper rate than if it could have by condemning. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And thank you for a very interesting case. It's been a long time we've had a case such as this.
For the record, I would like to object to any factual arguments that were presented in the rebuttal that were not presented either in the initial brief or the reply brief. There was one citation to the record in the entire argument section of petitioner's brief, and respondent was left to deal with no factual allegations being made in the initial brief, basically.
Okay. Thank you very much, and your objection is noted. That's the end of this argument, but thank you very much, counsel. We are going to adjourn until our afternoon argument, but if the students can say, Justice Kelly will be with you momentarily. Thank you.